This week's episode is brought to you by Ora Organic, a beautiful plant-based supplement brand passionate about using organic, powerful plants to support your health, whatever you're going through. What I love most about Ora Organic is that all of their products are free from synthetic vitamins and additives and have been designed by a qualified nutritionist to ensure the highest quality. So from sleep support to gut health, Ora Organic have something to offer you. And I have a 30% discount code. So head to ora.organic and use the code STEPPY30 to receive 30% off your first order. Hi everyone, and welcome back to the Alchemy of Life podcast. I'm Steffi, your host, and today's guest is Lottie Bowser. After the traumatic death of Lottie's fiancé Ben in 2020, Lottie has made a promise to wake up and live no matter how hard it may be, knowing that so many people don't get the privilege to do so. Lottie had a meeting with a psychic to explore the realms of life after death, and since then has been able to back up what she always felt to be true, that while Ben in his physical existence has passed, his spirit lives on. Lottie is a writer, a grief educator, advocate, she is a widow, and to me, she is the embodiment of the alchemist. Lottie, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, gorgeous. I'm honoured to be here chatting to you today. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And so I knew Lottie a little bit before Ben passed. And whenever we would meet at a yoga studio or with friends, I just felt good being around you. You've got such an amazing energy and you're full of life. And I remember the silly little videos you'd upload of you and Ben in the kitchen dancing and cooking. I really felt like it was this unique, but a mirror almost of me and Will's relationship, and that there was so many similarities. And so for our listeners today, I would love if you can to share a little bit about beautiful Ben and his story and your story.
Absolutely. It would be my honour. I absolutely love talking about Benny. So we met when I was 24. I'm 32 now. We met in 2014 on a dating app, nothing particularly romantic. But since our first date, it was like fireworks. It was like this coming home to each other. And I just knew, even though I was really young, I just knew that I'd met my person and that we were supposed to spend our lives together. And when you know, right? And linear time is kind of insignificant when you meet the person that you want to be with. And so things moved really quickly for us. We were in a relationship within a few weeks. We'd moved in together a few months after that. And I spent the rest of my 20s with him. And life was just magical with Ben. He was a real fairy dust person. And I know that that comes through in the videos and the posts that I share about him, but he was magic. He was like the walking embodiment of love and light, right? Just such a beautiful person. His bones were good. And I would wake up every morning and thank my lucky stars that he chose me to spend his life with. And I often thought to myself that it just felt too good to be true, right? We were creating this fairy tale life together. It was incredible, beyond my wildest dreams, amazing. And we were just on the precipice of the next chapter of our lives, engagement, marriage, babies, that kind of thing. And in July 2019, we discovered that a lump I'd found between Ben's shoulder blade and spine a few months before was actually a stage 3 soft tissue sarcoma, a malignant peripheral nerve sheath tumor. Now, Ben was the healthiest person going. He was so vibrant, so vivacious, so full of life. The last thing we thought this could be was a rare aggressive cancer. So it completely flipped our lives upside down and inside out. And it was so shocking to the both of us. He was, I think, 35 at the time. And as I said, fit, healthy, just it came out of nowhere. We didn't see it coming at all. And he was fast-tracked through a treatment program, which was really successful. He had surgery, radiotherapy, the radiotherapy was supposed to be like an insurance policy to stop the cancer from coming back. And we thought that we would have at least 10 years on our side, you know, just 10 years of the all clear. And we finished that year getting engaged and thinking that that would be the end of it, right? That we could move forwards with our lives and we'd look back at that summer and it'd just be this crazy period where, you know, Ben had cancer and yeah, that was hopefully going to be the end of it, but it wasn't. Fast forward 3 months, the day after his 36th birthday at the end of March, at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, he went for a routine checkup. Didn't think anything of it. The doctors were taking a little bit longer than usual to call us in after his scan. And it was at that appointment that we received the news that it had spread to the lungs. So the cancer had metastasized within 3 months of finishing radiotherapy, which was basically unheard of. It was just so aggressive. And it was now considered terminal. And you can imagine receiving that news. I can actually feel it in my body now, the trauma of that. You know, it was just the most horrific, traumatic experience. It's like our world just imploded. And this was, you know, at the height of the virus. And so Ben had overnight gone from a healthy, vibrant martial artist and successful music agent on the threshold of marriage and babies and all the other things that we were working towards together, to suddenly becoming a terminally ill cancer patient that needed to shield from the world around him because he was considered really vulnerable. So we went into lockdown, as did the rest of the world. But when I say lockdown, I mean Ben and I basically did not leave that flat besides, you know, walking up and down Stroud Green Road in Finsbury Park just to conserve our sanity. Occasionally, I was catapulted into the role of his primary and only caregiver. And obviously this is completely unprecedented for me. I have, you know, I got a B in GCSE science. So I haven't got a fucking clue, right? And you're suddenly having to advocate for the person that you love most in the world. And we were really intent on exploring alternative treatment options. We didn't just want to take the NHS's word for it that this would only ever be about extending his life as opposed to finding a cure. So every single waking moment of every single day was spent sifting through, you know, medical papers, clinical data, research, speaking to doctors all around the world, not just within the NHS, but in the US and Germany, exploring anything and everything that might give him a hope of survival, a chance of survival. And so this process kind of, it was, you know, ongoing throughout that summer. He had surgery to remove some of the tumours from his lungs. He had chemotherapy. And all the while we were trying all of this alternative treatment too. So getting the cancer tissue sampled, exploring, you know, genetic testing and immunotherapy. We were juicing a lot, exploring different dietary protocols, using off-label medicine, coffee enemas, THC oils, visualization, all of the Dr. Joe Dispenza meditation stuff, you name it, Steffi, we fucking threw the kitchen sink at it. You know, there wasn't a single stone that was left unturned. We did everything and none of it worked. Nothing helped at all to even slow the spread down. In fact, it seemed to just continue to spread even more quickly, like wildfire throughout his chest. And by the end of August, so this must have been about 6 or 7 months after the initial, or after the terminal diagnosis, the NHS had given up on him. There was nothing else they could do for us. And essentially, the next viable step was to start talking about end-of-life treatment and looking at hospices for Ben. And that wasn't an option for me. You know, I was so intent on him surviving and healing. Looking back on it now, I think it was most probably denial, an inability to consider a life without him.
It's also a lot of hope.
It is a lot of hope. And, you know, I'm glad that Ben had that. I'm glad that I helped to instill that in him, because he he did see possibility and he did feel hopeful. But after that final appointment with the NHS, I found an alternative cancer center in Tijuana, which is a border city just below San Diego in Mexico. And within a week, our bags were packed and we had our flights booked and we were heading to the other side of the world to explore treatment, which was essentially our last hope, right?
Gosh, I would just like to say in this moment, I can just really visualize you two and like, God, the courage. The courage of you both, just these two young people going for life, really, for life.
Yeah.
For everything. And you can just see it and just like the courage and the love and fucking hell, the strength.
Well, there's nothing that you wouldn't do, right?
Of course.
You would move heaven and earth for the person that you love, right? So that's what I did. And by this point, Ben was completely incapacitated. Chemotherapy had just ravaged his body. And, you know, looking back on it now, I realized that he was actually already in end stages of his life. He'd experienced irreversible muscle wastage, cachexia. So, you know, he looked very different by that point. But it was that little sliver of hope that, you know, we needed to hold on to because the other option was just unfathomable. So we had special assistance throughout that entire journey. He was, you know, wheelchaired onto the plane and we had first class flights and we stopped over in Mexico City for a night, arrived in Tijuana. And for the first time throughout the course of this terminal diagnosis, we were received by a medical team that were confident in Ben's ability to heal and to turn this around. And it was amazing, right? It was full of positivity and optimism. And
I remember this time when you were sharing on Instagram, it was like something, you know, there was so much hope and it felt like something could happen here. And it felt very, very hopeful.
And we had it felt like we had the whole world behind us. Ben was a much loved music agent within the music industry, and we'd gone public with his story a few months beforehand because all of the options we wanted to explore outside of England's healthcare system obviously cost a shit ton of money. So we needed to do some fundraising, and that also allowed us to, you know, go to Mexico to this center because treatment there was quite expensive. But a few weeks into the treatment, things were going really well. Ben's energy was beginning to come back. His hair started growing back. I, you know, having witnessed his journey so intimately, really it was him and I throughout that. Nobody else was able to come in and support us, at least physically, in person, because we needed to shield, to protect him. I saw a really drastic change just within the course of a few weeks. And things were on the up. Within 4 or 5 weeks of treatment, he went for another scan and the cancer for the first time in 7 months had been stabilized. So there was no more growth. And you can imagine receiving that news after months and months of bad news. You know, it was just like, it was the lifeline that we needed, and it was the most incredible feeling in the world. I remember, you know, just we were both crying and crying with disbelief, really, that we'd managed to halt it in its tracks. And we started making plans. You know, Ben, I suppose he was quite reluctant in getting his hopes up too much, but, you know, that was really the first time that he felt confident in his ability to be cured. Now, that was really short-lived. Within a week or two, both of us began feeling quite unwell and we developed a cough, and neither of us thought anything of it because we were in this safe bubble within the cancer center and we were only seeing other patients and doctors each day. We would go from the cancer center back to the hotel cancer center, you know, that was what our day to day looked like. And because obviously he had a lot of cancer burden in his chest, his cough was more severe than mine. And we decided to stay in one night at the hospital just so that his cough could be monitored by the overnight team there. And it was getting progressively worse throughout the night. And I remember feeling quite concerned about him. And he was sat upright in a chair. By this point, he needed some assistance with getting oxygen into his lungs. So he was wearing an oxygen mask, and he had an oximeter attached to his index finger, which is a little device that measures your oxygen saturation levels. And as you can imagine, I didn't sleep a wink that night. I was wide awake, just keeping an eye on him and making sure that he was breathing, that he was stable. The next morning, his vital signs had begun to deteriorate quite rapidly, and I didn't have a clue what was going on at this point. You know, only a week beforehand, he'd received really positive news that the cancer had been stabilized, that things were on the up. So I just remember being in that hospital room and the doctors becoming increasingly concerned about his situation. And they were all speaking in Spanish around me, so I didn't know what was really going on. And within half an hour, Ben's oxygen saturation levels were plummeting. And the doctor said to me, he needs emergency treatment. He needs to be taken to A&E. We can't treat him here. This is an urgent case. He needs urgent attention. Ben was obviously conscious, but his breathing had become so labored that he wasn't able to communicate his experience. In order for him to be admitted to the hospital, they needed a $10,000 deposit straight away. So I had to go into his pockets, pull his credit card out. The ambulance had been called. The paramedics rushed into his room. He was lifted up onto the stretcher. Again, his breathing was becoming more and more labored. He wasn't able to speak, really. And I remember just being consumed with terror and panic at that point. He was rushed out of the cancer center into the back of an ambulance. I jumped into the front, and then we raced down the motorway across the city to the Red Cross Hospital there. And the paramedics rushed him through the entrance to the hospital, and that's where we were separated. So we were torn apart. As I tried to run in after him, the security guards came and stopped me and prevented me from entering. And the last thing Ben ever said was Lottie. So yeah, he shouted my name. And I just remember he was sort of sat upright in the stretcher with this oxygen mask on, and I could see his oximeter flashing red. And by that point, just to give your listeners some insight into O2 saturation levels, anything below 93 is considered a cause for concern, right? And Ben's had dropped below 40. So he was already critical by that point. And I just remember falling to my knees, to my hands and knees in the dust. Everyone was speaking Spanish around me. I didn't understand what was going on, but I knew, given the way the paramedics had responded, that things were really, really critical. And 15 minutes later, one of the doctors came out to speak to me, and he said that we're going to try our best, but you know, your fiance is very critical. And I thought, what the fuck's going on? He was fine a couple of days ago. What has happened? And I remember walking in to the intensive care unit, and the protocol at that point for visitors was to dress in all of the COVID-19 protection wear. So the hazmat suit, the latex gloves, the mask, the goggles, the hairnet. I put all of that on, and they allowed me to go in and see Ben. And he was sort of lying unconscious under a plastic sheet on his belly with tubes in his mouth, and he'd been ventilated. So he'd been put on life support within you know, 10 minutes of being admitted, basically. And it was just the most surreal experience, you know, to have witnessed other patients, you know, walking through the corridor to his room. I'll never forget seeing that, seeing the inside of, you know, the COVID-19 wards and seeing other patients lying lifeless on ventilators. Ben was on life support for 24 days. And over the course of those 3.5 weeks, his condition oscillated from one day to the next. Stable, critical, stable, critical. It was just this constant roller coaster, not knowing whether he was going to live or die, and, you know, having so much hope and then being just completely, you know, brought to my knees all over again. And all the while I was in quarantine as well. So just to backtrack slightly, Ben was diagnosed with COVID-19 with a severe case of the virus and acute pneumonia. Now, obviously, because of his cancer burden, he was much more severely impacted than, say, me, for example, who just had a bit of a tight chest and a cough. I quarantined for 14 of those 24 days by myself in a hotel room on the other side of the city with, you know, only phone calls with friends and family and Instagram really for company. And because his case was, you know, had been taken public and people are aware of his ICU admission, I was keeping people up to date with Instagram posts and press releases. We were needing to fundraise as well in order to pay the hospital bills, because it cost around $10,000 to $15,000 a day to keep him on life support. 24 days after his admission, I received a phone call that I prayed and hoped would never come. And it was the doctor saying that Ben's liver was failing. And by that point, you know, there's nothing that can be done to save him. So I remember it was such a visceral experience to hear those words. I remember just shuddering uncontrollably. The trauma was so intense. It was like this earthquake ripping through my body. And I got in a taxi. I raced towards the hospital. My best friend Jazz was with me at the time because she'd flown out to keep me company. And 5 minutes outside of the hospital, 5 minutes away from the hospital, I received another call and it was too late. Ben had died. And my whole world went black. It's difficult to even remember really what happened next. You know, it's like those moments flicker in my mind like images on a TV, right? Disrupted by a broken signal or something. And I think perhaps that's my brain's way of trying to protect myself from really going to that place. But I wanted to see him, right? I had to see him for one last time. And so I went to the ICU again, hazmat suit, latex gloves, mask, goggles, hairnet. And I went in and just collapsed on top of him, you know, the love of my life. It was the last time I'd ever see his physical body. And it was just so inhumane, Steffi. You know, I had latex gloves on. I just remember ripping them off in just this, like, a rage, needing to sort of touch him, touch his hair, his skin, kiss him, say goodbye to him, you know. And I left the hospital and proceeded to spend the next 2 weeks stuck in Tijuana, having to cut through all the red tape around his repatriation, because he was diagnosed with COVID-19 and that was on his death certificate, even though it wouldn't have been present in his body at the time. They refused to let us transport him home and have the cremation there. So the cremation took place in Tijuana. I wasn't allowed to be present for that. So Ben was cremated alone. And then 2 weeks after that, I bound an airplane with his ashes in my rucksack.
I was thinking about this the other day. Was that like allowed? Or were you allowed to take his ashes on a plane like that?
You're allowed to take human remains across borders, yeah, but you have to show the death certificates. You have to take the ashes out. It's this big ordeal. You've got to pop them on the conveyor belt. They've got to go through the
conveyor belt.
Yeah, they've got to go through the scanning machines. You've got to show them the death certificate. You're interrogated. You know, it's such an inhumane experience. And all the while, I am so traumatized. I'm so shocked, you know. I don't know which way is up or down. I can't discern my asshole from my elbow at this point. You know.
Fuck.
Yeah. And England was in another lockdown. I couldn't possibly fathom going back to our flat in London and spending lockdown there alone. So I went to the Cotswolds and moved back in with my mum and stepdad for the next 4 months, where I, you know, was only had them for company. And my grief devoured me. It was just the most unrelenting 24/7 mind, body, soul experience. The pain of his death was all consuming, right? There were so many days in the early aftermath that I would wake up and wished that I hadn't, right? Suicidal ideation in the context of profound loss. I think particularly partner loss, when you've lost someone that's so inextricably woven into your moment-to-moment, day-to-day existence, is, you know, suicidal tendency is often quite present in people that have experienced that kind of loss. But I knew that I couldn't inflict the pain that I was feeling on the loved ones around me, right? So I held on. If not for me, then for my family and friends. And I knew that in order to survive Ben's death, I was going to have to find a way to carry it. And so I was very proactive. I poured myself into countless books, grief resources, books about signs, mediumship, the other side, life after death. I watched dozens of documentaries and films and interviews and podcasts. And I began talking about my experience online. It was really my only outlet, you know, given that we were in another lockdown and we couldn't even have a funeral with more than 30 people in attendance, no social distancing measures. All of the rituals surrounding death, you know, that need for community was absent. It was taken away from me. So I found comfort in connecting with other people online who had also experienced loss, whether it was partner loss or sibling loss or parent loss. And, you know, over time, the all-consuming nature of my grief began loosening its grip. It began to let up, and there was more space, you know, between the really crippling waves of grief. And yeah, I wouldn't say that it's got easier. I would say that I've just got better at carrying it. You know, it's shifted and it's changed shape a lot in the last 20 months since he died. But yeah, it's to recount the story, Steffi, is wild for me. And I actually don't often cry because I'm somewhat detached from it.
You almost have to disassociate a little bit, almost for protection. Like, it's almost like totally. Someone else's story, probably, in a sense.
That's exactly how it feels. Yeah, it's like I'm telling somebody else's story. You know, it's hard to believe that I survived that, looking back at it, you know, because at the time I didn't see that it was possible to survive it.
And so do you think some of this piece of the survival for you and the will to carry on, do you feel like that's all linked to your spirituality and the sense of like life after death and your experiences with Ben? And has that been able to help you expand back into this life rather than close off from it?
100%. I would say that my spirituality is probably the sole reason, you know, besides, of course, my loved ones, but it's the primary reason as to why I am still here. the notion that Ben had just ceased to exist, you know, that all of that beautiful, curly haired, tan skin, vivacious, angelic loveliness had just disappeared in a puff of smoke, was so devastating to me that it completely destroyed me. And I was fortunate enough to have already been walking a spiritual path over the last decade. And it's interesting now looking back at that, because I wonder if that was almost
repeating.
Like, I really feel that. I wonder if you know, it was preparing me for what then came 10 years later at the age of 30. But I would say that it has been pivotal to my survival for sure. And I always, you know, through my experiences with plant medicines and meditation over the years, I'd always had a sense that there was something more beyond this experience. You know, there's light waves and sound waves bouncing around all over the shop. Just because we can't see them, it doesn't mean that they aren't there. But there are people that can see them, right? There are people that can see and feel and connect with spirits, with entities, not just people that have passed over, but, you know, other entities not of this world. And so in those early days, within the first sort of few weeks and months out from Ben's death, I, as I said, just became engrossed with documentaries, films, podcasts, listening to conversations with other people who'd experienced bereavement, but also psychic mediums. I'd booked in a couple of sessions myself, and they were just completely and utterly mind-blowing. They confirmed everything that I thought to be true. And it gave me so much hope and comfort in knowing that one day, whether it's tomorrow or whether it's 50 years from now, because the reality is anything could happen at any point, right? None of us know what even the next minute holds, let alone the next day. The notion that I would be reunited with Ben again was just so incredible. You know, it puts a smile on my face even now to think about, because I know that he's waiting for me and he's chilling and it's probably fucking incredible there. And you know that too, because you know, the veil becomes so thin with these spiritual practices and with other modalities like plant medicines, mushrooms, ayahuasca. You know, they are portals into the other side, and you get a taste of that, of the divine. And so knowing that he's there and there's no degree of separation where he is, right? He hasn't carried any of his bodily, earthly suffering with him. I've had that confirmed to me by mediums. You know, he is in a place of oneness and bliss, and he's just waiting. And where he is, for me, you know, 50 years feels like a long stretch, but really it's going to be a blink.
Yeah.
Right. And then we're together for eternity.
Yeah. Time is it's a conditioned way of, it's not real. It's how we are conditioned to live. And it's not real.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Precisely.
And so I remember once on your Instagram stories, seeing you, I think you'd maybe just moved to Lisbon or you just moved into a new flat or something like that. And of course you and Ben's song came on and it's like, just this like affirming that he is present, he is here, and you know, he's supporting you. And I share a lot of this stuff with my friends and family about these kinds of things, and just like my deep knowing, like, to me it's not that I am right, but it's just like a knowing, like it's the ultimate truth, that is no coincidence, that there's no coincidences in life, it's not some like accident, it's absolute like spirit. And can you share any experiences like that, or maybe go into more of that, where you felt a presence of Ben, or perhaps your experience with the psychic, or where you've really, it's not been something that you've been grasping for, it's been true and present.
I think there's been a little bit of both. Things have just unfolded unexpectedly, but then I've also sought it out myself. And actually, I remember the afternoon before Ben died, I kept seeing certain number sequences, 444, 444 on the bills, 444 on the clock, 444 on, you know, the highway. And that particular number sequence is all about protection, right? And a message that you are divinely protected. A few days after Ben died, I kept seeing 111, 1111. And I don't feel like that's a coincidence. You know, your listeners might want to look into angel numbers, but those sequences have meaning. And when I was in Tijuana waiting to, you know, transport his ashes home, I was sat in this little cafe in the arse end of nowhere on the other side of town. And, you know, this is Tijuana, and this song came on, and it's a really obscure song by an underground Canadian artist. It was one of mine and Ben's favorites. And I just thought, fuck, he's giving me these little signs to know that he hasn't left me. He's left his physical body, yes, but he's everywhere now, actually, because energy is limitless, right? That song was followed by another one of our favorite songs by another artist that hardly anybody knows. And I just kept experiencing things like that over the coming weeks and months. And as I dove deeper into the other side, you know, the concept of continuing bonds, so like reshaping your relationships with deceased loved ones, finding ways to communicate them with them non-verbally, I would ask for specific signs. And of course, every time he fucking delivered, right? And it would just be these little nods, these sort of messages of reassurance that, babe, I'm here and we're still a team. And, you know, I have felt that consistently for the last 20 months. But you have to be open to it as well, Steffi, right? Because I've spoken to some people who are also experiencing bereavement, who feel very disconnected from loved ones that they've lost and who haven't received anything by the way of messages from them. And they're very closed off to all of it. And you have to be open. You have to be open and you have to invite it in, and also get specific about what it is that you want. You know, the more specific and unique a sign you can ask for, the more conviction you'll have when they are delivered. There's a really great book actually written by a famous medium called Laura Lynn Jackson, and it's called Signs. And I'd encourage anybody that's interested in connecting more deeply to this to have a read of that.
And I've read in some of your writing, by the way, everyone, I've just been literally like geeking over Lottie for about the past 48 hours, like reading everything, watching everything, aww, going through every single Instagram post. And you really usefully for our society speak a lot about like this lack of integration of death in life, like in Western society. If you go over to the East, you know, you go to India, death is very much part of life, and in a way it's celebrated, it's very integrated into life, and that's why they live so richly, because it's not some dirty secret that's swept under the cupboard, like it's never going to happen to me and it's never going to happen to my loved one, because it inevitably is going to happen to us all. It's the one great truth, isn't it? And so as someone living so closely with an experience of death, with death of your absolute loved one, in this society, what is that like, and how can we all do better to integrate death into life?
It's a really good question, and I'm glad you mentioned it, because, you know, there's one thing trying to come to terms with the death of your loved one, and there's another thing then having to navigate society's ineptitude at navigating it and holding space for your grief. I found it to be an incredibly isolating experience, not least because I'd lost someone at this age, but also because I'd lost a partner, right? It's not that common. I don't know anyone within mine and Ben's wider communities that have experienced this at the age of 30. That's why to have sought out other people online, you know, this is one example where social media really can be a tool for good, was so imperative for me in coming to terms with my loss and integrating it. But you're right, as you say, it's the one great truth. It's the only guarantee in life. And so isn't it then a great disservice to every single living human being in our society not to talk about death, right? And I feel if we talked about it more and we looked at our mortality more, then it's not to say that it would be any easier when we are confronted by it, but that perhaps we'd be a little better equipped at carrying grief. I think there's a lot to be learned from other cultures that, you know, hold its gaze, that celebrate it. And I think it's probably down to the fact that, you know, within secular cultures, at least, we see death as an end point, right?
Yeah.
That we're gone and there's nothing beyond that. Which is why I've tried to invite people to perhaps, you know, just open their minds and hearts to the possibility of something beyond this, because there's comfort to be found in that. And, you know, death marks the end of a life, not the end of a relationship. Like, you still love that person. In fact, I feel like I love Ben even more.
Yeah, that love doesn't go anywhere.
No, it doesn't.
Only grows.
It grows. Of course it does. And it's like, it's a lifelong process of integration. It's never something that you're going to get over, you know? It doesn't have a time frame. You don't just clap your hands after year one and think, right, I'm done now. It's an upwards trajectory from here on out. In fact, for me, year two has felt in some ways harder because the permanence has set up, has kicked in now, right? Now the dust has settled. So yeah, I feel it's so important to be having these conversations. And actually, by acknowledging our impermanence, you know, what Ben's death has taught me is to grab each day by the bollocks, to live as full and as meaningful and as purposeful a life as I can, because I might fucking die tomorrow, you know? Therefore, why not try and make the most of it? Right, live with that sense of urgency and that gratitude for what is.
And what does that feel like in the mornings then, when it's you're in the depths of grief or life is shit, you don't like what you have to do that day? For us who haven't been maybe so close to death and very much have a gratitude for life, but it's maybe not as poignant as yours are, because you know it, what death is, and so what is to live. I was speaking to Emma Cannon about this on my last episode. She's, you know, living with cancer and for so many years, and she, you know, in many ways, she's like, it's the greatest teacher, because I am really living with death at the forefront. So it fucking hell, I know how to live. And you look around and people aren't living, you know. So so when it's hard, what does that look like for you? Or is it, can you even put it into language? What is it really to live then? Is it to say yes to things? Is it something more? What is it? To feel it all? I don't know.
To feel it all, exactly. That was exactly what I was going to say, because what I learned very early on is that so many things can coexist, right? You can be in the most crippling pain of your life, in the darkest night of the soul, but you can also laugh and experience joy and lightness alongside that. It's not one thing or another, right? It's this constant and. It's like a hodgepodge of all of it, sort of swirling and merging with one another. And I think that acknowledgement that shit, this is permanent, this is something now that I have to carry for the rest of my life, compelled me to carry it as best as I could, right? To compelled me to cultivate the tools to live alongside it. And I think it's exactly what you just said about, you know, saying yes to life. My motto for 2021 was quite simply, fuck it, do it, say yes, reach for joy, grab it by the balls, because it's always going to be there. So, you know, why not? Go for it.
I love
that.
Can't control
what happens, you know, shit will happen. Terrible things happen to really good people for no rhyme or reason. But what I feel we are in control of is how we embrace those experiences, right, and all that come with them.
Absolutely. I love that, reach for joy.
Yeah.
Reach for it.
Yeah, absolutely. it doesn't mean to say that, you know, the pain, the suffering, the sadness won't be there, but you know, you've got to do what you can do to try and soften it.
And I saw that recently you were at Glastonbury, which I gather was one of you and Benny's like places. And did you bring his ashes to Glastonbury?
Yeah, so I'm sprinkling a little bit of his magic all around the world. I'm taking him to Burning Man as per his wishes in his will in 2 weeks from now. But oh God, I'm feeling quite apprehensive about that experience, but again, just embracing it, you know, ups and downs, peaks and troughs, highs and lows. It's going to be, you know, everything mixed together. But yes, I did take a little piece of Benny to Glastonbury, and it was amazing. Like, we took him to, we took the box to the NYC Down Low, which is, if anyone has been to Glastonbury and hasn't been here, you have to go. It's like the best nightclub in the world, like hands down. It's the best. It's like this gay club, drag queens everywhere, just nudity. It's very very liberating. We took him there, and you know, he was like on the dance floor with us, and our friends were like pretending to pour him drinks, and it was just, you know, it was just beautiful. It wasn't weird. It was just beautiful. It was he was with us. And there were so many incredible synchronicities and signs throughout the course of the 5 days that I was there that affirmed to me that he was there, that he was really present, as he is with, you know, all of these things. So yeah, that was really special. And I feel very intent on, you know, flying Ben's flag high and making sure that people know about him and that his legacy carries on, because, you know, for those of us that survived the loved ones that we lose, that's the way to carry them forwards, to make sure they are still a part of our lives as time passes.
And so, Lottie, you've written an e-book, a comprehensive grief support workbook, that's called Now What?
Now What?
And so for anyone listening who might be, you know, experiencing grief, has just lost a loved one, what can they expect from that workbook? Ebook.
The grief workbook is supposed to be a hand holding people through the experience of bereavement. We've included a load of practical suggestions and tips, along with journal prompts, because we both found, my co-writer Elodie and I found, that writing about and reflecting upon our experience was really cathartic and therapeutic. And we've also included guided meditations. So in those moments of all-consuming grief, those SOS moments where you just need a moment of reprieve to help you, you know, press pause and pull you out of that, people can be guided through 10 minutes of breathing exercises and meditation. Yeah, and it's been really beautiful to receive feedback and, you know, messages from people saying that it's been really supportive for them, because, you know, unfortunately it still remains this stigma. It's still shrouded in stigma and so much misunderstanding. And I think really what the book is it's just, it's, you know, it's that friend that gets it. And it's so important to feel as though your grief is witnessed, like truly witnessed.
And that's something, as we've said, that our society just doesn't have the tools or capacity, really, well, doesn't feel like that. It's just not part of our society. And hopefully through all the amazing work that you do and being in bloody 2022 and a little bit more waking up people, that we can embrace it as part of life. And so if anyone is listening, do you have one piece of support to share with someone who's maybe just got really daunting news or is going through something really huge like this? Is there anything, one thing that you'd like to share with them, or a piece of advice?
Well, in the context of grief, I would say that there is no right or wrong way to do it, and to try to soften any expectations you might have of yourself, or just quieten the noise regarding the expectations of others. There's no time frame. It could, you could be 2 months or 20 years out of your loss and it still hurt just as much as when you received that news on day one. And it requires radical self-compassion and kindness and patience. And it's not linear either. You know, sometimes I feel like, oh, I'm through the worst of it. You know, the only way is up from now. And then I feel like I've been pulled 10 steps back and I'm in the thick of it, in the thick of the pain and the grief again. But it's not linear, you know, it's a bumpy road of integration. It's not that we ever get over it, but we do get better at carrying it. I wouldn't say, again, that it gets any easier. It's just that it changes shape. And there is hope. You know, I never could have anticipated, you know, day one, 14th November 2020, the day that Ben died, that I would be here talking to you now, finding purpose in the pain, making lemonade from the lemons, and actually feeling happy, Steffi, feeling happy, feeling proud and grateful of and for the life that I've created amidst my loss.
So powerful, Lottie. And finally, just before we go, what's the greatest lesson then?
For me, death has taught me how to live. It's taught me how to open my eyes every morning, pull back the covers, plant my feet on the floor and say yes. And it's not just for me, you know, it's for Ben, it's for my dad, it's for all the other loved ones that I've lost, all the people that would love to be here that don't have the opportunity to.
Thank you, Lottie. Thank you for sharing that. And for anyone who wants to connect with you, where can they find you?
They can find me on Instagram at Lottie, L-O-T-T-E, Bowser. Lottie Bowser, my full name.
Wonderful, Lottie. We love you. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much. So are you, sweetheart. Thank you very much for creating this podcast, for having these conversations. I know it's helping a lot of people. Thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you next week on The Alchemy of Life.